good crowd this evening. Glad that you are here. If you want to even open up to Luke chapter 10, we will get there in just a few moments. You know, sometimes it's hard to decide what you're going to preach about, specifically on a Sunday night, because when you think of a Sunday night crowd, you think of a crowd that knows more than your Sunday morning crowd. And you think of a crowd that is maybe a little more into it than your Sunday morning crowd. That's not always the truth. That's not always the case. And there was something that Michael said a few weeks ago that I got to thinking about. And I tried to decide, well, would this be a Sunday morning sermon? Would this be a Sunday night sermon? And I'm going with it Sunday night. And I'm going to go ahead and tell you, I have no idea what to title the lesson. I've entitled it Three Killers. It's three things that will absolutely kill a mood. It will kill enthusiasm. It'll just kill. And I got to thinking about it as Michael was preaching a sermon a couple weeks ago from John chapter 11 when we were talking about the resurrection of Lazarus. And he made a statement about how one of the biggest things we have to fight against is people and their apathy towards the resurrection of Jesus. And apathy is a word that I think most of us in the audience know what it means, but in case there's someone that doesn't know that word, apathy is the word don't care. And I got to thinking about that as I was thinking about fulfilling our purpose in work. One of the fastest ways to kill a business or to lose a job is not to care about your job. And I got to thinking, well, what's another way? And I thought of three that tied into work, but in essence were really spiritual killers. And so I got thinking about this because of apathy. So what killer number one is the apathetic person. The person who does not care at all. Work, the Lord, Christ, church, whatever, they don't care. I would venture that the majority in this audience have some care. And I thought about what's the opposite of someone who doesn't care? It's the person who is passionate about it. It's the person who has passion about something or someone. And guess what? I don't care about things that you care about, I can about guarantee you. Because there are probably some of you in the audience who care about politics. I couldn't care less about politics. But you're very passionate about it. I am very passionate about sports. There are some of you in the audience who couldn't care less about sports. And we might ask the other person, do you not care? Because their apathy kills us. How can you not care about this? And Martha was that way. If you're there in Luke chapter 10, we normally think of Mary and Martha because of their brother Jesus, or their brother Jesus, their brother Lazarus. But they come on the scene and we learn about them first in Luke chapter 10. Now I want you to begin in verse 38. So they're traveling along, as Jesus and the disciples, and he entered a village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. And she had her sister, called Mary, who was seated at the Lord's feet, listening to his word. But Martha was distracted with all her preparations. And she came up to him and said, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the serving alone? Martha, Jesus, I'm doing all the work here. Don't you care? Tell her to get up and help me. And Jesus said, oh, you're right. Mary, get up, help her. No, what does he say to her? Martha, Martha, you're worried and you're bothered about so many things. But one thing is necessary. For Mary's chosen the good part, which shall not be taken away from. And you might look at yourself, and you might find yourself in that situation where you care more about making sure that you are a good, hospitable person than the person who would rather be at a Bible study or would rather be sitting there listening to the teaching, but you're too busy running around trying to do all the other stuff to make those who are in there getting the teaching work out. And he's saying, no, no, no. She's chosen the good part. Not that you've chosen anything that's bad. She's chosen the good part. Mary would be like, Martha, don't you care that he's in there teaching? And Martha would be like, don't you care that I'm out here serving? And the mood is killed because they're not on the same page. Or imagine, remember that story with Jesus and his disciples? They're on the boat. And we were talking about this, some of us yesterday, about a storm comes up when you're out on the water. And we know those two boys, that storm came up and they're lost. Remember Jesus is on that boat and his disciples. And Jesus is asleep on the boat. And the disciples come to him. Master, do you not care that we're perishing? I think that would have been me. Jesus had her under control, didn't he? Don't you understand? Peace, be still. And they were like, do what? Who is this that even the winds and the waves obey? They cared about the wrong thing. But they still cared about something. And there are things in spiritual lives that you care about. And there's somebody else, I guarantee you, sitting across the pew from you that doesn't care about it. And what are you going to do about that? Are you going to let it kill your passion? Or are you going to be a Mary who sticks to the good? Or the Jesus who understands what is going on? You care about the right thing. So the passage that was just read for us in Acts chapter 8, right? You begin in Acts chapter 8. I want you to flip there. And the reason why I thought about this particular passage is because you have very passionate people on both sides of this. You've got Stephen, who was very passionate that Jesus was the Christ and that the Jews who were practicing the old law and saying that he was not the Christ, they were wrong. Very passionate about it. To the point where he's willing to stand in front of them and say, you stiff-necked and uncircumcised in ears and heart, you always resist the Holy Spirit. That's passion. And guess what? They were equally passionate about it. They stopped their ears, they gashed their teeth, and they ran at him at one accord, and they stoned him. They equally cared on opposite spectrums, didn't they? So there are other Christians. Great persecution arose, right? And they flee. And what do? They went and they scattered and they didn't say anything about Jesus. Right? No. They told them. They preached the gospel in all the surrounding cities. Why? Because they cared. They cared that Jesus had died for them. And they didn't care if that meant they were going to get beat or that they were going to get run out of town and have to move again. They cared about it. The gospel spreads further in the book of Acts. I want you to go to Acts chapter 18. The gospel is in Corinth. And those of us in our young adult class downstairs, we know how bad the city of Corinth was. And it was a bad, bad place. But Paul goes into that city and the Lord tells him in verse 9, don't be afraid, but go on speaking. Don't be silent, for I am with you and no one will attack you in order to harm you, for I have many people in this city. So Paul gets the okay from the Lord you tell them everything they need to know and don't worry about it. Everything's under control. So he stays there a year and 6 months. It's a long time for Paul to stay in a place. So we have him talking. And I want you to pick up in verse 12. There's this guy named Gallio. And he was the proconsul of Achaia. He was a ruler over that area. And the Jews, with one accord, rose up against Paul and brought him before the judgment seat. And they said, "This man persuades men to worship God contrary to the law." They cared, didn't they? The Jews cared so much that they brought him to the judge to say, "This man is against the law." And now notice how it goes. As Paul was about to open his mouth, proconsul spoke up, Gallio spoke up. He says, "If it were a matter of wrong or a vicious crime, O Jews, it would be reasonable for me to put up with you. But if there are questions about words and names and your own law, look after it yourselves. I am unwilling to be a judge of these matters." And he drove them away from the judgment seat. You came to the wrong place. You're barking up the wrong tree. They still cared. Notice how they still cared, verse 17. They all took hold of Sosthenes, who was the ruler of the synagogue, and they beat him in front of the judgment seat. And here it is. But Gallio was not concerned about any of these things. Do what? How can he not be concerned about that? They're beating this dude right in front of you. I don't care. Has that ever happened to you? Something is happening right in front of you that is blatantly wrong. I don't care. Guess what happens? You just kill it. Everything is airs right out of the balloon. Because you didn't care about something that should have been cared about. So we sang that song, "I gave my life for thee." Do I even care? Could I care less that Jesus gave his life for me? Some people probably couldn't care less. And I don't know how you're going to combat that. You can't make somebody care about something. You can't do it. You can't force it. All we can do is say, "Do I care?" And we have to ask ourselves the question, I might say I care, but what am I bringing to you? I gave my life for thee. What hast thou brought to me? What are we giving? Those first century Christians, they were willing to give up a lot because they were passionate about the one who had died for them. The second killer that we see is people who were satisfied. We might use the other word, complacent. They're good. They've got all that they need. And I thought, well, what's the opposite of being satisfied? In food terms, I'm hungry. I got everything I need versus there's more that I need. I want more. I don't have enough. In work, you reach a certain level in your company, you say, "Yep, this is all I want to do. I'm good. I've topped out." Or maybe I don't want to go anymore because it's going to require all this extra effort. Or, "Oh, I got everything," whatever the case is, as opposed to the other person who's still hungry. They've reached the level and they want to keep going more. That happens spiritually too, doesn't it? Paul worried about that in Philippians 3, and we talk about that a lot, right? "Not that I have already obtained," and Michael preached on this not too long ago, so I'm not going to harp on it much, but I want you to flip there and just notice those things, right? I haven't got what I'm looking for. Other people might look at me and say, "Man, you've made it. Man, you have gone a long way. Look how far you've come from being a blasphemer and a persecutor and a murderer. But he wasn't done. Verse 12, I've not already obtained, and I'm not already perfect. I'm not complete, but I press on that I may lay hold of him. Now I want you to notice verse 15. Therefore, let us therefore, as many as are mature, perfect, complete. Let's go with mature. The person who is satisfied. They look at themselves and they would call themselves spiritually mature. What are the attitude are they supposed to have? Forgetting what lies behind and pressing to that which lies ahead, back in verse 13. The complacent Christian kills himself. He's done. He's reached all that he needs. He can't go any further. He's plateaued. And he's satisfied with that. He's very pleased. He's not disappointed that he's plateaued. He's like, yeah, I'm here. I have arrived. I'm going to kick it in retirement gear. Mom was telling me just this week. So there's a guy at the congregation where they attend. He's 96, 95, something like that. Very sick, on his deathbed. And she was saying that he said to her a few weeks ago, I'm just not sure there's anything else I can give the church. It's a 95, 96-year-old man saying, I still wish I had something I could give the church. But I think my time is there. And rightfully so. How many of us tap out at 30? 40. Okay, I'll give you 60. I'm good. I've been in this church 50 years. I'm good. Or the person who is still hungry. I'm pressing toward it. I ain't there yet. I'm pressing toward it. So think about some other passages about that. Think about the disciples, Jesus' disciples. I want to go to John chapter 4. And I want you to see if they were hungry or if they were satisfied. Because Jesus kind of mixes these two analogies and illustrations together. Remember, that's the woman at the well. And they've gone off to get food because they're hungry. And while they're gone, that's when Jesus talks to the woman at the well. And he finds out all that information about her. And he comes back in. And the disciples are looking at him, verse 31. They say, Rabbi, eat. He said, I have food to eat that you don't know about. And they looked at themselves and they said, no one brought him any food, did we? What are they thinking about? Actual food. Got something else for you. So Jesus said, verse 34, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish, to finish his work. So don't say, or do you not say, and here's where he turns on them. Do you not say that there are 4 months and then comes the harvest? So, regular harvest time with the crops in the field, 4 months away. Yeah, 4 months away. But notice how he turns it. Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look on the fields. They are white for harvest. What did he just say? There are people out there who need to be harvested. It ain't 4 months away. It's right now. And guess where it was? Right in front of them. And I think he's using a play on words as the Samaritans were coming out of their village towards Jesus. Like, man, we are going to harvest right now all of these souls. And they didn't get it. It was right there in front. Now I have to ask myself the question. Are there things that are right there in front of me? Whether it is spiritual growth, whether it are people that I can teach that are right in front of me, but I'm just so satisfied with where I'm at that I don't see it because I'm not hungry. I'm complacent. And we know about Paul. He just wanted to preach. He felt like he was under obligation to preach to barbarian, to Greek, anybody and everybody. He wanted to preach to them. And he wanted to preach to those in Rome. But as he closes out his letter there to the Romans, in Romans chapter 15, I always find this very intriguing. And I wish I had a map, but I'm dumb sometimes and forget. Like, I think of maps, but then I forget to put maps in the PowerPoint itself. But he talks about these places where he's preached. And we can picture where he's preached, right? Jerusalem, in Damascus, in Asia, in Turkey, in those areas. And he's preached all over the place. And he's wanted to go a little further west, and he's wanted to go to Rome. And he's got up into this place, and we would find that he's even gone to this place called Illyricum, up in basically the far northwest of that time. And we don't have any record of him going up there to teach. We just have him saying he's been there to teach. So he's preached in all of these places. But yet he is eager to go. And I want you to pick up in verse 19. So in the power of signs and wonders and in the power of the Spirit, so that from Jerusalem and round about as far as Illyricum, I have fully preached the gospel of Christ. And thus I aspire to preach the gospel. Where? Not where Christ already was named, so that I wouldn't build a foundation on anyone else. But verse 22, I want to go to places where the gospel has not been. I want to go to these places where they never heard it. And so he mentions Spain, verse 24. I want to go to Spain, and I hope to see you on the way. And you might say, Paul, you've been preaching all over the world. Why keep going? Because he was hungry. And he urges the Thessalonians, who have been told how they ought to walk in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, and they were walking in that way. They were conducting themselves in such a way that was pleasing. But notice verse 1. You walk this way, but I want you to excel more and more. You're doing right, but you need to do more and more. Then verse 9, with brotherly love. Now as to the love of the brethren, you have no need for anyone to write to you. For you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. For indeed you do practice it toward all the brethren of Macedonia. They're doing it all over the place in their area. But we urge you, brethren, to excel more and more. I'm doing good. I'm doing good stuff. I'm living the way I ought to live. But am I hungry to do more and more? If we get a bunch of satisfied people, we're going to do less and less, not more and more. Third killer. The old selfish individual. The person who's looking out for number one. He doesn't care about really anybody else. He cares and she cares about themselves. And we kind of know the opposite of that one, don't we? The selfless person. And we know that if how a person, and kind of, if a person is selfish and they've got all these ambitions in work, they can make a lot of headway, can't they? But on the way, they are going to destroy some people to get to where they are. They're going to take advantage of somebody. They're going to step on somebody's back. They're going to do something. And guess what? They don't care. Because they got what they wanted. But sometimes we do things that look selfless that are actually selfish, don't we? The obvious example is our old buddy Judas. Our guy who was walking around with Jesus, and Mary comes and she anoints his feet with that precious, expensive ointment. And he's like, why wasn't this sold to give to the poor? And the other disciples sitting around probably like, yeah, why wasn't that sold to give to the poor? John lets us in on a little secret, doesn't he? He didn't care about the poor. He cared about taking that money out of the bag. You ever find yourself doing that? You do something that's good, but you're really hoping that you're going to get something out of doing it. That selfless deed that will eventually kill. Because it eventually comes out that it wasn't so selfless. It was selfish. So Paul would say there in 1 Corinthians 13, right? If I give all my goods to the poor, but I don't have love, what do I profit? Nothing. And if I give my body to be burned, but I don't have love, what do I profit? Nothing. You and I from the outside would look on that as, man, he died for Christ. He gave up all his stuff for the brethren, for the poor. But the person didn't do it for that. They did it as the Pharisees did, so that everyone would know their good deeds. That's a killer. Or maybe we have situations where preaching is done out of envy, right? You remember that in Philippians 1, where Paul's in prison. He said, man, the brethren are much more bolder to speak now. And some do indeed do it out of envy and strife. And I want you to focus on another term there in Philippians chapter 1. Because this is kind of what blows my mind and why I didn't want to call this lesson a killer. But in essence, it is a killer in one sense. Notice verse 15. Some, to be sure, are preaching Christ even from envy and strife, but some do it from good. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am appointed to the defense of the gospel. But the former, the group doing out of envy and strife, they proclaim Christ, and here it is, out of selfish ambition rather than pure motives, thinking to cause me distress in my imprisonment. You know what I'm going to get, Paul? I'm going to preach about Christ, and he's going to be so jealous that I'm preaching all these people about Christ and I'm making all these disciples. He's going to wish he was out of prison. He could do that too, and I'll show him. And everyone's like, man, look at how some brother so-and-so is preaching now. Look at sister so-and-so is doing. And the only reason they're doing it is selfish ambition. That's a scary thought. Or you got people like in James chapter 3. And you know this is one of my favorite passages, I guess. Well, people get so selfish and they get so smart and so wise. So James asks the question in verse 13, who's wise and understanding among you? And I wish I could see the reactions as this letter was being read in the various churches of how many of the people would be like, yeah, I'm wise, I'm understanding. Or probably kept their hand in the pocket but thought, yeah, I'm wise, I'm understanding. How do you do it? Let him show by his good behavior, his deeds in the gentleness, humility of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, don't be arrogant and lie against the truth. Don't claim that you're so wise when you know in your heart you only care for yourself. That's not the truth of the gospel. Because that is verse 15. That's not heavenly wisdom. That's not wisdom that's from above, but that's earthly wisdom. That is natural or sensual. It's demonic. It's the way that you feel. Because where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder and every type of evil. You find people who are looking out for themselves, you find all kinds of evil. It's there. Because they'll do anything to get ahead, to get their way. Whatever it takes. As opposed to the person who in their humility of wisdom does this, verse 17. The wisdom that's from above is pure, it's true. And it is peaceable. It is there causing peace between people. It is gentle. It is reasonable. You can reason with that individual because they're using their wisdom and their faculties. Not only thinking about themselves. They are full of mercy towards other people. And they are bringing forth good fruits, and they're unwavering without hypocrisy. They are truly people who care and who serve others and merciful and all of those things. And so what does that produce? Not every form of evil, but it produces righteousness. And those who sow in peace, they make peace. You get two selfish people going at it, right? Who's going to win that one? Satan wins that one. That's a good point. The stronger wins that one. You get two selfless people who are going at it. Who wins that one? They both give to the other. They both compromise because it's not about them. And finally, we know old Diotrephes, the one who loved the preeminence, right? He loved to be first. And so when the brethren came from afar, he was like, get out of my church. But some of the other brethren apparently took him in. I want you to notice what was said about those brethren there in John chapter 3. Or 3 John, not John chapter 3, but 3 John. What is said of those brethren who took them in. He said, verse 5, beloved, you're acting faithfully in whatever you accomplish for the brethren. And especially strangers. Why was Gaius doing what he was doing? For the brethren. For brethren that he didn't know. Not for himself. And they, the ones that you have helped, they testified to your love before the church. They told everybody about it before the assembly. And you will do well to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God. For they went out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing from the Gentiles. And therefore we ought to support such men so that we may be fellow workers with the truth. Help them. Don't look for anything to come out of it. Help them. So that you can do what? Be fellow workers of the truth. Not getting a name. But I wonder if this guy down in verse 11, in verse 12, this guy Demetrius, I wonder if he actually was one of the ones who received the brethren. And kind of like opposed the Diotrephes who loved to have the preeminence and he kicked them out of the church. I wonder if Demetrius, verse 11, beloved, don't imitate what is evil, but what is good. The one who does good is of God, and the one who does evil has not seen God. Demetrius has received a good testimony from everyone and from the truth itself. And we add our testimony, and you know that our testimony is true. It's almost like Diotrephes looks like he's the one who's in control. And he's the one that has all the power. But really the one who has the influence and who has the power and is right is Demetrius. And it probably looked like he was getting walked all over. But he was selfless, probably helping those strangers. So as I look at myself, we sing that song, All of Self and None of Thee. And we all know we lie on verse 4. When we say, Lord, Thy love at last is conquered. All of self, none of self, and all of Thee. But we're not really lying because I think the idea is that's what we want. When it's all said and done, we want that. But how many of us are stuck in that place? Some of you and some of me. Well, we're satisfied with that. We don't really care about getting any more, emptying ourselves anymore, getting more of Christ. We're satisfied. And as long as we get our way most of the time, we're good. I'll give up my way some of the time, as long as I get it some of the time. As opposed to individuals who are always selfless, who are full of Christ and what Christ wants. Don't be a killer. Don't kill the enthusiasm of those around you. Don't kill a church because you're apathetic. Be passionate because Christ gave His life. Be hungry. Don't think you've attained. We haven't got there yet. Be hungry, not satisfied. Be pleased with where you're at. That doesn't mean you're not pleased with the growth. That just means you ain't ready to quit yet. And thirdly, be selfless, not selfish. If we do that, we won't kill the body. We'll strengthen the body. We'll edify the body as the body builds itself in love towards that full man in Christ. Subject for the invitation in any way this evening, we'd ask you to come now as we stand and as we sing.